Today, Australia and the China factor. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour. I've had a number of people ask me about whether what's going on in China could impact our economy here. And of course, the answer is yes. But then once you start unpeeling the onion, you realise that this is quite a complicated question to try and answer. So I'm going to make a show today which does go some way towards answering that particular question. Of course, China has long been a reliable source of growth for the global economy, but that reliability is, well, looking increasingly shaky. As the world's second largest economy, China's fortunes cast a long shadow, and so the recent headwinds deserve more attention. This last week's news that the country's GDP rose more than forecast was greeted with sighs of relief, but some analysts advise that the slowdown risk is rising. And of course, this is important for us in Australia, as China is Australia's largest two-way trading partner in goods and services, accounting for nearly one-third of our trade with the world. Actually, according to DFAT, two-way trade with China declined 3% in 2020, totaling $245 billion. Australia's global two-way trade actually declined 13% during that period. Our goods and services exports to China totaled $159 billion in 2020, down 6% compared to 2019. That decline was largely reflective of exports being muted as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic, actually down 36% in 2020. And a series of trade restrictive measures by China has also impacted Australian goods exports to China, which were around 7% lower than in the second half of 2020. I'll come back to those restrictive practices later. So what gives in China? Well, some of this is self-inflicted by the COVID zero policy, and some is because of the shift between the yuan and the US dollar. So today I wanted to explore this in more detail. The US 10-year treasury yield has risen rapidly to three-year highs, and it's erased its gap with its Chinese counterpart, something that hasn't happened for more than a decade. And as the yields cross paths, the US one rising above China's, that theoretically at least reverses an investment strategy that brought Chinese bonds for the greater return they offered relative to US treasuries. Now, it's not immediately clear whether the move will be sustained and big enough to have large-scale implications, but the development is a market signal that investors are watching. The US yield climbed above its Chinese counterpart early last week for the first time since 2010 and has tried to hold onto a small premium in the last few days. The market development reflects diverging monetary policy between the two countries. The People's Bank of China is loosening monetary policy and cutting rates, while the US Federal Reserve is tightening monetary policy and raising rates. China and the US also face different inflation dynamics, with surging producer prices in both countries, but smaller consumer price increases in China, at least so far. So investors are watching the implications of the narrowing yield gap for the Chinese yuan. A worry is that if the yuan weakens too much, that could lead to capital outflows. Currently, there is no sign China or the United States will shift their monetary policy focus. Zhou Jiang, bond analyst at Hangzhou-based Naho Futures, said in a Chinese statement translated recently. Both sides' interest rates will continue to exhibit relative independence, he said. In this process, the yuan exchange rate will play an important role as a buffer and also be an important indicator for the future. In the last few months, the yuan has traded near three-year highs against the US dollar, but right now, China's high trade surplus more than offsets the impact of the narrowing yield gap in the yuan. Larry Hu, chief China economist at Macquarie, said, "The Chinese yuan will face more depreciation pressures from a decline in China's trade surplus. In fact, the convergence of the US and China 10-year yield is not that big a deal," said Hu, "since the gap has been narrowing for more than a year. A country has a trade surplus if its exports exceeds its imports, and China reported a trade surplus of $47.38 billion in March, down sharply from $115.95 billion in the January to February period. Now let's turn to China's GDP, which, as we said, rose 4.8% this year's first quarter on a year-on-year basis. That's up from 4% in the previous quarter, but a closer look suggests that trouble is brewing. Retail sales, for example, fell 3.5% in March from a year earlier. That's the first slide in nearly 2 years, and most forecasters still expect China's growth engine to remain intact for the near term, but only at a relatively modest decelerating pace. The government's growth target for this year is roughly 5.5%, and that's a strong gain by standards of the West, but for China, it marks the softest increase in 3 decades. In fact, a 5.5% increase in 2022 looks increasingly unlikely as the country struggles with multiple challenges. In fact, the government admits that the road ahead will be rocky. We must be aware that with the domestic international environment becoming increasingly complicated and uncertain, the economic development is facing significant difficulties and challenges, China's National Bureau of Statistics said last week. Although Q1 GDP was better than expected, some analysts are predicting that Q2 may be even less forgiving. One clue is the rising unemployment rate in 31 major cities in China. This indicates the unemployment problem in the larger cities has become more severe than when the COVID pandemic started in 2020, says Zuhui Zhang, chief economist at Pinpoint Asset Management. The COVID outbreaks only forced Shanghai and some other cities to enter lockdowns in late March and early April. Therefore, the economic slowdown likely worsened in April. In fact, analysts at Société Générale warn that China's economy is in distress. The problem, as we've repeatedly stressed, is that the lockdowns are still in place and are spreading. Nomura China chief economist Ting Lu and his team agree. In a research note sent to clients, they estimate that the Chinese economy most likely contracted in April. Amid expansive lockdowns, logistics disruptions, the downward spiral in the property sector and slowing exports, we expect activity data to tumble in April and gauge that the risk of a recession has been rising in the second quarter. So a key question is, how much will China's government offset deaccelerating growth with fiscal and monetary support? Another critical variable is whether the government continues to pursue its zero COVID policy, which contrasts with much of the rest of the world, which has increasingly started to learn to live with the virus. By some accounts, the longer China tries to stave off widespread infection, the bigger the eventual blowback when the policy is abandoned. Further impacts from lockdowns are imminent, not only because there has been a delay in the delivery of daily necessities, but also because they add uncertainty to services and factory operations that have already impacted the labour market, said Iris Pang, China chief economist at ING. We may need to revise our GDP forecast further if fiscal support does not come in time. An analyst at Reuters' Breaking Views division advises that the zero COVID policy puts China at risk of a self-inflicted recession. Then, not everybody agrees. While the economy is struggling, it's not in serious trouble, according to Derek Scissors, chief economist at China Beige Book, a consultancy. We're not looking at outright contraction as China suffered in 2020 when the pandemic was raging. The optimistic narrative is that once Beijing has the current COVID-19 outbreak under control, the government can fully refocus on supporting the economy through fiscal and monetary stimulus. There's already been some signs that the government is aware of the risk here and that there's more talk about policy support, said Richard Yesenga at ANZ. Got a possible joker in the deck is China's inability to contain the current outbreak. In that case, the relatively upbeat expectations for China's economy could quickly turn to dust, which would have implications for an already strained global economy, courtesy of stronger headwinds thrown up by the Ukraine war. The pandemic has to be the biggest source of risk for China's growth this year, said Jing Li, chief China economist at Allianz Bernstein. But of course, the question is, how big is the risk? It's still open to debate. The critical variable is deciding how much faith to put in China's efforts to do what no other nation has achieved, stamping out the spread of COVID-19. But the combination of net investment outflows and the slowing domestic economy signals troubles more widely, not least for Australia, as we continue to be heavily reliant on exports to China as well as imports from China. In terms of exports, Dr. Anne Holmes noted that as the drivers of China's growth change from urbanization and basic manufactured goods to domestic consumption and more complex goods and services, the growth in demand for Australia's resources will moderate. Australia's resource exports to China will likely continue to grow, but at a slower rate, with natural gas to some extent supplanting coal. Other commodities such as wool and wheat and other minerals will probably also do well as incomes in China rise. Australia's terms of trade are likely to fall, though, as new coal, iron ore and gas capacity in both Australia and the rest of the world comes on stream. And a probable result is that the Australian dollar will fall, and that will mean a partial reversal of the huge rise in living standards, which, contrary to popular perception, perhaps Australia has experienced in the last 10 years. At the same time, it will improve the competitiveness of other traded goods and services industries, which have suffered from the strength of the currency. China may be a market for some of them. And on imports, 90% of Australia's merchandised imports are from China, and of those, 90% are elaborately transformed manufactures. The initial imports of textiles, clothing and footwear were replaced by household appliances in the 1990s. Today, 50% of Australian merchandise imports from China are engineering products, including office and telecommunications equipment. When Australia had the temerity to call for an independent inquiry into the origins of COVID-19 last year, China, of course, was incensed. It responded with an unprecedented wave of trade restrictions that froze many categories of Australian exports, rapidly decoupling economic ties. But if Beijing hoped to punish Canberra for its defiance with economic pain and send a warning to other countries not to oppose China, it failed on both counts. The impacts on Australia have been surprisingly minimal so far. If this is what decoupling from China looks like, Australia's resilience suggests the costs are far lower than many assumed. The fact will not be lost on other countries that have differences with China. Australia-China relations have long been marked by a fundamental tension. Economically, the two sides have been increasingly intertwined, with Australia providing many of the commodities on which China's industry relies. In April 2020, the Australian government led an international call for an independent inquiry into the still murky origins of COVID-19 in Wuhan. An incensed Beijing quickly denounced Canberra's call as an affront and political witch hunt. The reprisal came just 1 week later when the Chinese ambassador to Australia threatened consumer boycotts of several products in response to Australia's call for the investigation. Then in May 2020, China applied massive anti-dumping duties on Australian barley, pricing a $1 billion industry out of its principal export market overnight. But it did not have the intended effect of getting Australia to back down. Instead, the government responded defiantly, with Australian Foreign Minister Maurice Payne publicly accusing China of economic coercion. With the barley ban failing to produce the desired response, China doubled and tripled down. Beef was next, with several Australian producers losing their export licenses. More tariffs were applied to wine, while customs bans were slapped on wheat, wool, lobsters, sugar, copper, timber, and table grapes. China's importers were instructed to stop purchasing Australian coal and cotton, and electric utilities were encouraged not to buy liquefied natural gas on the spot market. The trade guns were still smoking when, in November 2020, the Chinese embassy in Canberra issued a list of 14 grievances that Australia was expected to correct to return to a normal relationship. But in fact, the effects have been surprisingly mild. The reason is trade diversion. When a trade barrier is erected, businesses seek alternate outlets for their products. In open international markets, the outcome is rarely the destruction of export industries. Most of the time, trade flows adjust around the barrier. Coal provides an illustrative example. Once China banned imports of Australian coal in mid-2020, Chinese utilities had to turn to Russia and Indonesian suppliers instead. This in turn took Russian and Indonesian coal off the market, creating demand gaps in India, Japan and South Korea, which Australia's stranded coal was able to fill. What's more, the global energy crunch has pushed up the price of coal, leading Australian coal producers' export earnings to rise this year, not exactly the effect that China had in mind. The result of decoupling for one of Australia's core industries was therefore just a game of musical chairs, a rearrangement of who traded with who, not a material injury. And many Australian industries successfully applied this tactic. Barley was redirected to Saudi Arabia and Southeast Asia, copper to Europe and Japan, and cotton to Bangladesh and Vietnam. Other sectors developed more creative workarounds. The beef industry sent cattle to be processed at abattoirs that still had export licenses, while lobster farmers used grey routes, for example, via Hong Kong, to enter the mainland. These successful diversion tactics greatly cushioned the blow for industries whose trade with China was suspended. As a result, the cost of decoupling the Australian economy from China has been far lower than anyone had expected. According to Australian Treasury estimates, sectors affected by Chinese trade restrictions lost around $5.4 billion in exports to China during the first full year of sanction, but they simultaneously found $4.4 billion of new markets elsewhere, and that loss, therefore, was $1 billion. That was a mere 0.25% of Australian exports. What's more, due to surging iron ore prices, the value of Australian exports to China actually grew by 10% since sanctions have been in effect. Our economy has proven to be remarkably resilient, Australian Treasurer Josh Frydenberg said. In fact, though, we do remain locked tight into China. And if their economy does freeze, then that does spell trouble. But just how much is hard to know, given the number of moving parts in the system. We are still very much linked. And just to underscore that, let's look at the latest trade data for Australia. Australia's trade surplus surprised to the downside for February this year. The surplus, while still sizable, narrowed to $7.5 billion from a revised $11.8 billion previously. Markets had expected the surplus to print at around $11.7 billion, by the way. Imports surged, which is evidence of considerable economic momentum on the reopening from the Delta lockdowns, which disrupted activity over much of the second half of 2021. Imports posted a staggering 12.1% jump, up $4.4 billion. Little wonder the surplus narrowed, therefore. Strength was across consumption goods, broadly based, with 16.5% up on intermediate goods, notably industrial supplies, up 16.9% for services. And that, of course, was helped by borders reopening. And export earnings, after a sizable 6.1% increase in January on higher commodity prices, consolidated in February up 0.2%. Coal and fuel export earnings were reportedly little changed. Now, the partials, though, pointed to a rise in price and volumes. Metal oils, dominated by iron ore, declined, down $0.3 billion on lower volumes but outweighed by higher prices. And manufactured goods moderated, down $0.26 billion but partially reversing a sharp $0.5 billion in January. So looking ahead, higher commodity prices, in part due to the war in Ukraine, will boost export earnings and likely lift the trade surplus to fresh record highs. And by the way, the peak to date was last July at $13 billion. But, and here's the rub, if in fact our imports from China get caught up in the lockdowns and, of course, the supply chain disruptions, that's going to have a significant impact on our local economy. And on the other side of the equation, if in fact exports start to ease back because demand from China falls, that could have a significant negative impact on the economy here too. And whilst we can look for other markets, and that has been somewhat successful, it still looks to me as though we are very much locked in to what's going on in China. And the bottom line question then is, well, will China then go into a recession? As I discussed earlier, who knows? There are certainly some negative signs, but then, of course, they can do quite a lot more in terms of quantitative easing and lowering rates. And that's a very interesting phenomenon, given the fact that in the West, we are rapidly looking to raise interest rates and quantitatively tighten. So my bottom line is this: I'm actually not sure how this all plays out, but I have a nasty feeling that the downside risks on the Australian economy are greater than the upside. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.